The elephant in the parenting room is male laziness and the misogyny that birthed it. It doesn't matter how many parenting books I read, how diligently I learn to control my emotions, how zealously I regulate my nervous system. It doesn't matter how often I do the right thing if all my husband does is undermine it. I can patiently wade my way through her tantrums, but as soon as this man-child arrives on the scene, he either caves in and gives her what she wants or starts screaming, yelling, and spanking. And then, no matter what he does, he turns on me next, yelling at me about what a bad parent I am in front of her. This is the reality of literally every woman friend I have. Can we please talk about this reality when we talk about parenting advice? Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. And today we are going to be talking about this reality, as well as the more mundane realities of parenting toddlers and preschools who are notoriously difficult, except that our guest today does not think so. I'm here today with my guest, Devin Koontzman. Hi, Devin.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so thrilled to have you here. I was really excited when you reached out to me. And the thing that I love about Devin's work is that there are so many people who claim to be practicing gentle or respectful or authoritative parenting. Except they're not gentle or respectful or authoritative with their audience. They're condescending, they're shame-based, and they're often incredibly misogynistic. And I found Devin's work to be a breath of fresh air where that's really not happening. So thank you for creating that space, Devin.
Thank you. Thank you for seeing that in my work.
So before we get started, I'm going to tell everyone a little bit about Devin. Devin Koontzman, PCC, is the founder of Transforming Toddlerhood, a certified coach and a mom to a 3-year-old. She's on a mission to rewrite the narrative on the terrible twos and beyond, helping parents see toddlerhood as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build social, emotional, and relationship skills. As the original toddler parenting coach on Instagram, with a background in psychology and child development, Devin has guided tens of thousands of families worldwide to parent with more calm, confidence, and joy. Her new book, Transforming Toddlerhood, is designed to support, not guilt, parents, offering tools, encouragement, and a fresh perspective to turn this challenging season into one of the most meaningful chapters of the parenting journey. And her book will be out October 21st. I will put it in the Liberating Motherhood bookshop, but it's also available wherever you want to buy books, so you should definitely get it. And Devin, I'm just so grateful that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you about this topic.
So we're doing something a little bit different for this podcast. I sometimes do a Q&A, and that's how we're going to do it today. I asked y'all to give me your questions about parenting toddlers and preschoolers, and you did not disappoint. So I'm going to present them to Devin, not to put her at all on the spot, and we'll see what she comes up with for your real-world parenting challenges. And I think she and I will also talk about how there's always a larger social context for these challenges a little bit. So before we do get started, I want to acknowledge a lot of what our opening vignette nodded to, which is that parenting advice in some ways always involves telling parents, and let's be honest, mothers, that what they're doing is wrong. That's a message we get constantly in our culture. We aspire to perfection, and for many of us, the men around us think they can just show up and yell or show up and do nothing. It's maddening. So, if you're in a bad situation with your relationship, as statistically most women are, if you're with someone who undermines your parenting, I want you to know that you are not ruining your children. And I think that's one of Devin's messages is that you don't have to be perfect. This is not your fault. I hope you'll take what is helpful here, and anything that's not, just discard it. All we can do is the best we can with the tools we have. And our goal here today is to offer you a few more tools. Not to make you feel worse or more alone or like you're doing it wrong. So, with that, Devin, before we get started with specific questions, for readers who are not familiar with you, I wanted to ask you a bit about your general parenting philosophy. I find that it's really easy for parents, myself included, to get caught up in using like a specific script or in parenting in a very aesthetic way or a very specific style. But that's not really what good parenting is about. And we have to be able to be flexible as we learn about our kids' needs. And I like that you are open to that and talk about that. So, what would you say is your style? And what would you say are the core principles of good parenting?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that. So, when it comes to these scripts, it's a double-edged sword because people want to learn a new way of parenting and a new way of speaking with their children, and scripts are helpful, but then sometimes we take it too far and feel like it's the only way. And so I love that you mentioned this flexibility, because there's many ways to get to the same outcome. And so here at Transforming Toddlerhood, what I'm really focused on is empowering parents to create confidence in their parenting skills while dispelling the myth that toddlerhood is terrible. Because yes, toddlerhood is a very challenging developmental period, and there are times where it is just downright grueling, and we feel like we just can't take another day. And at the same time, it's a very critical developmental period that supports your child's brain development and sets the stage and the foundation for the rest of their lives. So, how do we balance knowing how important this developmental period is with how challenging it is? So some of our main principles here at Transforming Toddlerhood are that we want to work with development, not against it. So I teach parents how to decode their toddler's behavior and understand what behavior is communicating. So then we can work on addressing not the behavior we see on the surface, but what it actually means or is communicating. And that's how we create transformation. Another core tenet is that practice makes progress, not perfection. It's about the willingness to show up every day and to practice something new, to fall down sometimes, to make mistakes, and to try again, knowing that you don't have to be a perfect parent to be a good parent. And I'd say the last principle, and the thing that I really want people to take away from the book, is this idea that we're all human, that you are a human being with feelings, emotions, and needs, doing your best every day, and so is your child. So those moments where you feel like your child is having bad behavior, or you feel like that you're failing, these are just our feelings, and feelings are signals. They let us know what's happening on the inside, but they definitely are not facts. And so just knowing that you are a human being that's doing their best, and so is your child, can go a long way in working together to have things go differently.
I love that. I think that's lovely advice. I think one of the principles I learned early in parenting is I had very good parents. And when I was pregnant, I truly believed that I could be a perfect parent. I remember telling my husband, I can get through all 18 years and I will never yell at our kids. And then, of course, the real children that you have to parent come along. And it turns out that it's very challenging. And the thing that I've reminded myself a lot is that it's good for them to see that I'm human because it shows them how they're affecting other humans.
Absolutely. And this is the thing that is really interesting to understand, is that parenting is a relationship. It's one type of many relationships that we're in our lives, and that we definitely impact our children, and our children impact us. And this is why we don't really need to or want to be perfect parents, because all of the messy moments or challenging moments that we might look like as problems that need to be fixed are actually opportunities for learning and growth. And in those moments when you're actively working to ground yourself, when you're feeling like you're getting frustrated or triggered, or those moments of taking ownership and repairing the relationship after you yell, those moments of saying out loud what you want to do next time and practicing it, those moments that you're, teaching your toddler new skills, all of these things are showing your child that we don't need to be perfect to be good people. And it's teaching them the skills that they need to be successful in life, the emotional skills, the social skills, the relationship skills, all of the skills that they're going to need to have later in life. And whenever we come at this from a place of perfection, like just pretend, what if we were like robots and did everything perfectly? What kind of standard would we be setting for our children? And how would our children be able to learn all of these skills? Because modeling is one of the most powerful ways that we can teach.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So here is our first question. Speaking of perfectionism and dealing with challenging behaviors, my daughter is 2 years and 4 months. She's borderline autistic. And then she clarifies that what she means by this is that her testing is borderline. Regular parenting advice isn't working to stop her hitting, kicking, and biting. When she hits, kicks, or bites, it is very much a part of communication. It happens when she has appropriately asked for something and then been told no. She might ask a few times in a row before lashing out. If I will do my best to react calmly with a we don't X, then put her on the floor away from me or get up. I've done this so many times, but the behavior continues. It's predictable, and I'm usually able to dodge the bite. How do I get her to stop trying to bite me and beating up on me? I solo parent most of the time with a neglectful, angry, loves weaponized incompetence husband that I am working on leaving. I wonder if the behavior stems from his lack of consistency with her.
That's such a great question. And that's such a hard situation to be in when you feel like you're doing all the things and you've tried all the things and it's just things aren't changing. So I have a lot of empathy for this mama. Whenever I think about discipline and the challenges, right? Because when we, it's typical for toddlers to have all of these behaviors, right? To hit, kick, bite, especially whenever they come up against the limit, because we're, when children come up against the limit, they have to work to accept it. And they have feelings of disappointment, frustration, because in toddlerhood, they're trying to become their own person and they have their own agenda. So when we stop them from executing their agenda by telling them no, they get frustrated. And at this age, the best way that they can communicate that is physically through their behavior. And I hear this mama doing so many great things, setting that limit, following through on it. But the behaviors still keep happening. One thing that can be supportive here is getting to the full, what I like to call the full recipe for effective discipline. So focusing on the communication, the connection aspect, and focusing on the teaching skills aspect. So the recipe for healthy, effective discipline is creating connection, setting limits and following through, and teaching skills. So one thing that children need a lot of support with, and especially kids who are testing borderline on with autism and on the spectrum, is that need a lot of work with skills, sensory regulating skills, emotional regulation skills. And these happen in the calm moments. So, reading books about big emotions, practicing different activities that promote breathing, like blowing bubbles, pretending to blow out a candle, belly breaths, listening to short meditations together, starting to introduce these concepts in the calm moments is what's going to help kids move toward this place of regulation. And when you have a child who's very, very physical with biting and kicking, oftentimes when we want them to jump to just being calm, it's too big of a leap for them, especially at this age and especially kids that might have extra needs. So helping them go from an inappropriate physical outlet to an appropriate physical outlet can be a really great first step. So talking about afterwards, next time you feel this way, what can you do? I won't let you hit me. You can't hit mama. Hitting hurts. You can hit this pillow. You can bite this silicone teether. Giving a replacement way that's appropriate to get the physical behavior out is a great stepping stone to bridge the gap as you teach more of these coping skills. And sometimes getting the support of an occupational therapist that specializes in the sensory system can be extremely supportive of as well in these situations.
I love this advice, and I especially love that you mentioned the sensory bit. When I first started learning about sensory needs, I have to admit that I was like kind of dismissive about it. I thought, well, there are other things that come before this, and it's emotional connection and all of that. And it really took a long time for me to understand how prominently this sensory stuff figures, I think, to some extent with all children, but especially with some neurodivergent kids. So I love the alternative of giving like a pillow or a sensory chew or something. And I just want to add too, and you touched on this a little bit, Devin, this is a really young kid. This is effectively a baby. And I think in parenting, we have so many expectations and so much pressure placed on us that I often wonder if our problems with our kids are really problems of external worries. What's going to happen if she keeps doing this? What are people going to think of me? So 2 years and 4 months biting, this is just like a thing little people do. Doesn't mean you have to accept it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong with her or with you.
Absolutely. I think that is so beautifully said, because we get so wrapped up in the what ifs. What if this continues? What if this escalates? What if this never goes away? And then it creates this false sense of urgency to quote unquote fix a problem. And that's why in my book, Transforming Toddlerhood, I spend a lot of time. I have a, talking about the sensory system. I have a whole chapter dedicated to the sensory system and behavior red flags throughout the book to help parents understand what is typical behavior and what is behavior that may be outside the typical realm, and how to also use sensory strategies in different situations to support a child, because a child can be emotionally overwhelmed and they can also be sensorily overwhelmed. And toddlers at this age, their sensory system is still developing. And so there's a lot of things that that the sensory system can cause an impact, even if even if you do have a neurotypical child.
All right, our next one is this. My 4-year-old curls up in a ball and moves away from me when she's upset. She will shout at me that she doesn't want a hug or for me to say anything or to touch her or anything. But of course, I'm also not allowed to leave her. She says nothing will help her and sobs and sobs. It makes me sad in the moment that I can't work out how to help her, but I'm also worried for the future. How can I help her accept help or love when she's upset or angry at someone? I don't discount her feelings, and we can have good conversations about what she was feeling at a later time. I found the book How to Talk So Kids Will Listen a great start, and the suggestions have worked really well for my other two kids, but I haven't been able to work through this particular challenge with this child yet.
Yeah, this is such a great question. So, a lot of times, children between the ages 1 and 4 have competing needs. So, they want to be left alone because they're trying to be an independent individual, but they also want you nearby. And these competing needs can be really frustrating and confusing for both kids and their parents. And so, this is why sometimes you see children pushing us away and also wanting us nearby. At the same time, when you have a highly sensitive child, sometimes there can be a lot of shame and embarrassment around big feelings. There's a lot of self-judgment and things of this nature that tends to happen when children are more highly sensitive. And so that could be part of what's happening there as well. But I think that the most important thing is that validating your child's feelings and emotions and saying, you feel like nothing will help. I hear you. Because sometimes kids just need us to see them and to hear them and to let them fully release all of those feelings and emotions, even though for us, it can be so hard to hold space for the full spectrum of emotions, so hard to see our children upset. And when we give the space for the full emotional release without making it right or wrong or trying to fix the problem, I'm using air quotes here, fix a problem, then something beautiful can really start to happen there. And absolutely, this mama is having these conversations in the calm moment. So continue working on skills, having conversations about feelings and emotions, and reading books about big feelings and emotions. In the calm moments, because this is how we increase emotional resilience and learn skills.
This is great. So I was a child like this. I was an, I hate you, don't leave me sort of child. And I definitely agree. I think there's a lot of shame. I think there's a sensitivity component there and just getting overwhelmed. The other thing I would say is I think it's so great that you're able to talk through this with her outside of those moments. Our kids don't have to react in the textbook way. And there's no rule that you have to talk about the thing she's upset about when it's happening, and what she's showing you is she can't talk about it yet. I think it seems to me like this mom is already handling this great and is just worried that she's not doing enough, but I think she's doing wonderfully.
Absolutely. It's all a lot of parenting is about recalibrating our expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's see. I think this is from the same mom as the first question because it's a lot of similar details. Here's what she says. I am self-employed working from home with my daughter, 2 years, 4 months, in early Head Start for 6 hours a day, 4 to 5 days a week. I only get a few hours to work because of the travel time to and from her school. I do my best to only work in the evenings after she is asleep, but sometimes she doesn't go to sleep until it is my bedtime. Oh God, you poor thing. Sometimes she is off Fridays or Mondays, and sometimes I have to finish projects over the weekend. When I have to work, I use Miss Rachel and several other similar programs in English and Spanish to keep her from continually interrupting me. Is TV time really that bad? She is hitting all of her milestones and is ahead of most her age. She can even count to 20 in English, 10 plus in Spanish, and knows most of her letters. She does have symptoms of autism. I see all the time that TV is so bad, but am I really harming her?
Such a great question. I think screen time is one of the biggest challenges that we have to navigate as parents in today's world. And it's often really emotionally charged and can bring up a lot of feelings of guilt. I talk a lot about screen time in my book and have a chapter dedicated to it because it's such an important topic where I present a lot of research. And it's amazing that this little one's hitting all of her milestones. And the thing is that what I like to talk about is creating healthy screen time habits, which is going to look different for every family because every child is unique. Some children are going to be more sensitive to screens than others. Definitely, the younger a child is, the less screen time is better because there's more than a million neuropathways and connections being made every second in the first 3 years of life. And the pathways that are used the most are the ones that get wired and the ones that are used less. Are being used less. And so they get pruned away. And we know that screens can stimulate the reward pathways in the brain. That being said, though, that sometimes it's not about hitting milestones, like being able to, hit your speech milestones and things like that. Sometimes there is a sensory component where screens just are overstimulating for some kids and can cause more power struggles, tantrums, and meltdowns throughout the day. And it's a cumulative effect, and parents don't realize that that's what's happening until they take screen time away for a few weeks and then see a drastic change in their child's behavior. So, again, what you want to do is look at your unique child and see what and get curious about what is the impact here. What's happening with screens? And then also, whenever you're deciding to use screens, it's also about balancing it out with other activities. How much time is your kiddo getting to spend, like outside in nature? How much time are you spending reading together? And so, make sure that you can do other activities at times that help counterbalance being on screens. And also, one other thing is that some kids with sensory challenges actually find screens very calming at the same time. So that's why there's no right one size fits all approach for screens for children. We have to take the research and then we have to look at our unique child to understand the impact and create healthy habits for our families.
I agree with this. They're individuals. They're people just like us. Shocking, I know. Imagine that.
Imagine.
So I will say we were, my husband and I, we actually didn't have a TV for years. We were diehard anti-TV for all children for years. And then we sort of started experimenting with screens. And what we found is that we have one child who really benefits from watching TV and watching larger quantities of TV than I would have ever been comfortable with. It's soothing for her. She does other interesting things while she's doing it. And then we have another child who turns into Satan if she watches any television at all. So, a little hard to manage in the same house, but you just have to kind of see. I also think, like so many of these parenting questions, there's kind of some other hidden problems here. And one is the childcare piece.
Yes.
I have seen with mothers, first of all, childcare is inaccessible to many and unaffordable to many, and all of that. So if that's what's going on here, that's what's going on, and there may not be anything you can do about it, but you may want to explore like trading out with a neighbor, seeing if you can do kind of like a co-op thing with friends, whatever you can do to get some childcare. But then I also know moms who just feel so guilty about using childcare, and they think that they have to be with their child every second that they're able to be. And, no one ever expects dads to work without childcare. So I would look into the childcare piece. And I would also say that like some parenting is harm reduction. So even let's say we decide for this particular child that screens are not great. That doesn't necessarily mean we have to have an absolute no on screens because she's got a mother who has to work, and like working and making money is a need too. So I feel like I am sensing some like ambivalence about work and childcare wrapped up in this question.
Yeah, absolutely. I really probably should just correct myself and rephrase is that childcare is probably one of the biggest challenges we're going to face as parents of young children. Screen time and screens in general are probably the largest challenge we'll face over the lifespan of being a parent, but definitely childcare in the early years. And I've even had my fair share of childcare challenges and also the guilt associated with using childcare. And so I can really, really empathize with parents in these situations and in these moments. And I think one big concept to keep in mind when it comes to parenting is what we want to do is work on meeting our child's needs within our boundaries. But for something to be working, it needs to be working for our child and be working for us. But that doesn't mean it has to be perfect. So that might mean that there's times when we use a screen because we need to meet our needs. But then there's other times where we go outside or we read books because we're meeting our child's needs, and that, a lot of parenting is balancing everyone's needs, and everyone's needs might not always be perfectly met every moment. And that's part of that finding that balance is just knowing that sometimes one person's needs have to be prioritized over the others.
Totally. All right, this one made me laugh out loud because this question is like the story of my entire life as a parent and like every other parent I know. Here's what she says. My toddler does something I've begun to think of as the Hunger Games. She gets a snack, eats a bite, says she's not hungry anymore. Then 5 minutes later, she wants another snack. This can go on for hours. I understand the rules about parents offering food and kids deciding what to eat and not using foods as rewards and all of that, but this is taking up so much of my life. It's a huge demand on my time, a huge amount of intellectual labor, and to me feels like setting her up for really disordered eating. I never knew how angry the phrase, "I'm still hungry," could make me. What should I do?
Oh, it's so challenging. Whenever it comes to kiddos and, their food preferences and picky eating and all of the things, there's so many emotions and our own stories tied up into food and what we feed our children. In situations like this, there's a couple of things that we can do. It might be that there needs to be a little more structure around meals and snacks. So maybe it is like implementing some type of structure, which will be hard at first because children don't like change. Quite frankly, no one really likes change, right? We all kind of like, change is part of the unknown, and the unknown can feel scary sometimes. So oftentimes when toddlers meet a limit in an area that there previously wasn't a limit, they're going to have a pretty big reaction, whether it's crying, screaming, yelling, kicking, hitting, whatever it might be, because they're releasing their emotions about it. And there's a little bit of hope that the outburst might change things. So the number one rule with setting limits is to only set the limits you're willing to follow through on. So I want to recognize that if you decide to start setting limits around snacks, which might be setting out, the snacks for the day in the morning, and your child choosing to eat them whenever she wants, and then learning to like regulate herself with like, these are the snacks. Or whether that is in the morning, waking up, choosing what the morning snack it will be and the afternoon snack, and then letting those snacks be the snacks and not bringing out more snacks until those ones are gone and have been eaten. Same thing with a meal. Like if my child sits down to a meal and he eats like two bites and says he's not hungry, I let him dip down from the table. But then 15 minutes later, when he says he's hungry, I say, "Oh, good. I'm so glad you're hungry. Your food's still at the table for you." First couple of times, there was, a lot of pushback. The other day, we had a 10-minute meltdown because he didn't eat his lunch. It was 3 p.m. and I served him his lunch again, and he really wanted snacks. And after the 10-minute meltdown, he ate the rest of his lunch, not all of it, said his belly was full and forgot he even asked for a snack. He's 3 years and 2 months. So, anyways, it can be challenging to get over the hump of setting those first limits and creating that first structure because there will be pushback. But then life gets immensely easier once the structure is in place and everyone understands the structure.
So I love it that you mentioned structure because I have become sort of a structure zealot in recent years. And I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about this and get your thoughts because I've come to believe that all children just really do better with structure. And the harder it is for a family to implement structure, kind of the more they need it. I often find that my neurodivergent friends say, well, my kid really doesn't do well with structure. And what they really mean is that it's really hard for them to implement structure. And there's also kind of this notion that like structure means rigidity. It means being punitive and aggressive and mean, but it's not. It's just like helping kids know what to expect throughout the day. So can you talk a little bit more about this structure component and kind of setting up like the infrastructure of your family for success?
Yeah, well, structure is very important because, especially the younger a child is, but of course, structure is really important also for older children too. But it creates a sense of safety, and security, just like limits do. Because if there's not a limit, if there's not structure, sometimes that gives kids too much power. And yes, kids crave, a sense of control. They crave having power, but when they're too powerful, behaviors tend to snowball because they're looking for that limit or they're looking to come up against that structure. So, what I like to say in terms of structure is that you want to have freedom within boundaries. You want to let your child, say you have a strong-willed child, you need to set the boundaries, but then give them option and choices within those boundaries so then they have a sense of control. But you've created the boundary for it. Or whenever it comes to your day, like the way your day goes, instead of thinking of a rigid schedule, it's more of like a daily rhythm that one thing follows the next thing within a general time frame. Because remember, it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be like military precision. It needs to be predictable. More often than not, it's predictable that you're going to respond in a certain way. More often than not, it's predictable that something's going to happen. It doesn't have to be perfect. There's always room for spontaneity and surprises. And of course, life's curveballs as they always come. So, some places that we can implement structure is in different routines, like morning routines, evening routines. Structure around food and meals, structure around daily tasks or chores that we do in the home together as a family, even structure around things like who's putting the kids to bed, who's, like maybe parents might rotate and there's a structure for that, or who's going to choose the movie for movie night. And then it's rotating, and there's a structure there. So there's a lot of different opportunities to create structure. But again, structure means that something is predictable, it's not necessarily rigid.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. All right, I actually dealt with this myself this week, so I'm eager to hear what you think. What tips, tricks, and child-honoring perspectives do you have about helping littles take medicine? I'm all about body autonomy, so for the most part, we just skip it if she says no. Fortunately, the time we had antibiotics, it miraculously went pretty smoothly most of the time. But now she's recently been sick with a fever of upwards of 104. And none of us got decent sleep for a few nights in a row when she refused to take any medicine, poor kid. Do you have any special strategies or sanity-saving mantras for parents?
Oh, well, sanity saving mantras. So we have to understand that no matter what we think or our brains try to trick us into thinking, control is an illusion. We cannot control another individual. And we spend a lot of parenting fighting against that and trying to control our child, trying to control our parenting partner. When really the only person we can control is ourselves. And quite frankly, that's challenging at times, right? So that control is an illusion, would be my first mantra. Second, when it comes to medicine, it can be challenging, especially if you have a highly sensitive child. And especially in toddlerhood when kids push back against the things that we think. So I'm going to give some quick tips here. The first is, if your child refuses the medicine once, don't give up, try again. There are some a chewable medicine for when my son is sick that he refused. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's never going to take this. 2 months later, he got sick again. I gave it to him. Now he thinks it's like candy. He thinks it's the best thing ever. And he's asking for it now that he's better. And I would have never thought in a million years he'd ever accept to chew this medicine. So just because your child rejects it once doesn't mean that they're always going to reject it. So just like with new foods, exposure counts. And sometimes we need lots of exposures, 20 plus exposures before a child will say yes. And then try to make it try to reduce the pressure. So put the medicine out, but then walk away. Go get involved in something else and see if your child gets curious and comes back to it. Do your best to hide it in something else, even if it's something you might not typically give your child, like potentially, I'm trying to think of something that might have a stronger flavor, like chocolate pudding. My child does not like chocolate, so that would not work for us. But something that has like a stronger flavor that your child might be enticed to eat or drink. And then I would say in the end, bodily autonomy is so important, and it's our job to keep our kids healthy and safe. So sometimes we have to cross our child's bodily autonomy for things like proper use of antibiotics per se, like because you don't want to create antibiotic resistance, right? But maybe when it comes to something like a fever, and if the fever, isn't too high and not, causing seizures or something like this, maybe you can use some other home remedies to try to reduce the fever, such as, a cool washcloth, different things like that that can help reduce the fever until your child's willing to accept it. So as parents, these are some of the tough decisions that we have to make in terms of when is it absolutely necessary to cross our child's bodily autonomy to keep them safe and healthy.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I think here again, we see that sometimes needs are in conflict, and sometimes you both want to respect your child's bodily autonomy, and maybe they have a serious infection, and we also want to respect their continuing to live. So it comes down to, which is the higher value right now?
Absolutely. And maybe it's also changing the format. Some parents might have trouble giving like a liquid suspension, but if you can get a pill and crush it up and hide it in something, that might go down better. And I think that doctors and pharmacists automatically assume that a flavored liquid is like what kids will want. But sometimes a flavored liquid is way harder to hide in something than a crushed up pill. So always ask about your options as well, because sometimes there's options there that we didn't know about and until we ask.
I also really like your advice about exposures and to keep trying. And I feel like this is something I do as a parent, but I've never really thought very consciously about it. But I do feel like I see a lot of people say, well, he said no one time, and that's like a no forever. But I've got a kid who will, say that something is a hell no, and that she's gonna get us if we make her do it. And then like the next time we offer it, she's totally fine. So you never know what you're gonna get.
Yeah, because a lot of our children's reaction has to do with, how are they doing in that moment? How are their emotions doing? How are their basic needs going? Are they hungry? Are they tired? How's their sensory system doing and their sensory needs? How are their developmental needs going right now? Have they felt empowered today? Have they felt a sense of control, or have they felt like everything's happening to them and they haven't had any control over their lives that day? So that a lot of those things factor into how our child responds in any given moment. But you could ask the same thing sometimes 5 minutes later and get a completely different answer, or you just leave something out where your child is like, no, you walk away, and then they're doing the thing they just said no to, because it's like almost like they need to reserve the right to say no, and once they know their voice has been seen and heard, then they're fine doing the
Yeah, I think that's great.
thing.
All right. The next one, all she says is, how can I support my son with his fears about being dead?
Yes. Well, it's challenging for me to answer that question without knowing an age because there are different, when we talk about death, we want to talk about death in a way that's concrete with young children, but we don't want to give more details than what they can handle or that is developmentally appropriate. And so it would be helpful to know the child's age. But what I would say is that the biggest thing is getting curious with any challenging conversation. Any of those conversations that were like, oh my gosh, how do we talk about this? What are we going to do? Those things that feel really big and heavy. Getting curious. Where did you hear this? What do you think about that? How does that make you feel? Tell me more. I'd love to understand this. So just like getting curious, but then getting curious and curious and curious, because sometimes we got to, it's like peeling back the layers of an onion, right? Like we can't just get curious once. We've got to like continue the conversation to kind of get in there. And then from there, that can help us understand where our child's head is at, what they're thinking and feeling, and then better equipped to address what's happening. But typically, kids need a lot of love and reassurance in these moments. However, some kids can have anxiety and can have other challenges. And so then they'll get stuck on something and start to ruminate on it. And this is when it's supportive to get the support of a child therapist to support, because sometimes it's actually something more that's happening that is beyond what we may have the capacity to fully support and resolve on our own as parents. And there's never any shame in asking for support.
I love that. I think that's great advice. We've had to deal with this a lot in our family because we've had a lot of death in our family. Our second daughter died a year to the day before my mom died. And so our oldest was plagued with all kinds of anxieties and fears about death. And, it left us with some ideas about how to address it. So what I would say is that, I think part of why it's hard for us to talk to our children about death is that it's hard for us as adults to think about death. And I think maybe getting clear about your own values and your own attitudes and making sure that you don't bring your own panic about death into those conversations. I know a lot of people find it's easy to fall back on their spiritual beliefs, and there's, nothing inherently wrong with that, but if that's your sole source of comfort, it can become a problem if your child rejects those beliefs, because then they also will not get any of the comfort those beliefs offer. So for us, what we have done is we offer a lot of reassurance. We try to understand what our kids are feeling. And I've been asking my kids to think about life before birth. That wasn't that bad, right? We don't remember anything terrible about that. Well, as far as we know, being dead is about the same. And that seems to have been really helpful to them. Your mileage may vary. Every child is different. And I would just also add that, fears of death are usually really fears of separation. They're fears of being away from their parents, from people they love, of the unknown. So I make sure to reassure my kids about this and to tell them that my love and the things that I have taught them will always be with them, and that the people who love them are doing everything they can to be with them. And we talk a little bit about legacy too, that, legacy is what we build and how we live on through the good things that we do. This isn't going to work with a 2-year-old, but it will often work really well with a 4 or 5-year-old. So you just got to scale up or scale down based on your kid's needs. And, your kid talking about death, don't let it panic you, because I think as soon as kids start talking about being dead, parents start picturing their kids being dead, and it becomes very hard for us to think rationally about how to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. It because there's a lot of our own fears wrapped up in this, and there's going to be things that happen, whether it's your pet dying or even a friend's pet. Oftentimes, there's always opportunities to have these conversations and start bridging this topic. And often, I, recommend, it's not that you necessarily want to put ideas into your child's head, but also talking about things when they happen and not avoiding it because you're afraid. It's actually best because just because a child doesn't ask a question once when they hear about Maybe like a pet dying or a family member dying or a miscarriage or something like this. Just because they don't voice their thoughts and questions doesn't mean they don't have thoughts and questions and feelings about it.
Yeah, the avoidance bit I think is really important. We had an experience when my oldest was in kindergarten where her teacher's child died. And obviously, horrifically tragic for the teacher. But none of the parents told their children what had happened except for us. And none of them went to the funeral. And I thought, this is a pretty safe exposure to death. This is someone that they don't know. It's someone who's, the teacher's child, but not an actual child. And, this is a good introduction into how we can show up to support grieving people and how we can talk about these things. And, instead, the lesson that these kids learned is, you just hide from it and you don't show up to support the person. And I thought that was terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I was actually just at a funeral the other day, and there were a lot of 1 and 2 year olds there. It was their great grandfather who passed away. And I was so excited to see all of those kiddos there because, I think we want to protect our kids, but somehow the best protection is talking about the elephant in the room.
Yeah, and preparing them for the things that are tough, because eventually they're going to be exposed. And do we want it to be when they're 5 and we're there to support them, or when they're 50 and that they've had no practice? All right,
Absolutely.
I love this next question as our last question. Here's what she says. Devin, I started following your work several years ago and have really appreciated so much of your wisdom. Yes, practice makes progress. That's true for me as much as it is for my kid. And I have your reasons to love the toddler years printed out and posted at home. Thinking about how your work intersects with Zahn's, I would love to hear your advice about one of the biggest challenges I have been dealing with. How can I approach disagreements or outright arguments between me and my co-parent that arise in front of my kid? Conflict avoidance and suffering in silence were the main models I had as a child. So I would love to model constructive conflict management for her. But we do not manage conflict constructively 99% of the time.
It's so challenging. This is such a great question. And what I want to say is there's several levels of what you can do here. And one great place to start is to talk to your parenting partner and to see if you can come to an agreement to when someone is getting escalated in front of the children, if it's okay if the other person says, "Can we pause and talk about this later?" Or can we hit pause? Something like this, and kind of like agree on a phrase that can be said when one person notices the other person getting escalated. This is ideal if you and your parenting partner can come to an agreement around this. If not, that might not always be possible, but if it is, it can be really helpful because it's a great way to interrupt the cycle. To kind of end the conflict in front of your child. At the same time, that when we talk about repairing the relationship, whenever we lose it and yell, it's great to like put on loudspeaker and help children understand what they've heard or witnessed. So saying something like, "Mommy and daddy," or "Mommy and mommy," or "Daddy and daddy, we didn't agree here." And we started to feel frustrated and raised our voices. And we shouldn't have done that. Sometimes it's really hard not to yell whenever you feel frustrated. And I'm sorry that you had to hear that. It's not about you. We just didn't agree. And we're going to work it out. And next time we don't agree, we're going to try blank, blank, blank. So just kind of like walking your child through it, putting on loudspeaker what happened and kind of working through it. As I said previously, we can't control our parenting partners. We can only control ourselves. But what we can do is talk to our children about what they witness, about what they hear, and help them make sense of it and help give them a narrative to work through it. And that's probably the biggest power that we have and that we can use not only with like whenever we fight or have a disagreement with our parenting partner, but our children are going to see all kinds of things, right? They might go to school and have a disagreement with a friend, or they might witness a coach, a sports coach, being like inappropriately tough or saying something, right? And so, again, we can't control all the other people that our children are around, but we can help them make sense of their experiences.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I like the emphasis on not controlling your parenting partner. There's a whole range of ways these conflicts unfold and, ranging from you're both behaving inappropriately to you're actively being abused. And what I would encourage is, if you're not necessarily actively being abused, to think about what you can do to control your own behavior in the moment. Because if you can control your own behavior, you actually still can model healthy conflict resolution. If your partner's coming at you and going nuts, what you can model is saying, "Whoa, I'm not going to talk about this like that right now." And that is healthy conflict management, and it's boundaries assertion, and it's all kinds of stuff that kids need to see. Another thing that we do with our kids that they love and that has been really helpful, and we start doing like as soon as they can talk, is something we call the tricky situation game, where we'll present them with a scenario where someone's doing something wholly unreasonable, and what do you do in this situation? And they love it when we keep adding layers upon layers. So it starts with, this kid is yelling at this other kid at school. What do you think you should do? And then we'll add, and then another person on a bike rides by and throws garbage at you, and make it more and more absurd, but also more and more conflict to get them used to the idea of, like, what would I do in this situation that I might encounter? It's not perfect, and it doesn't necessarily prepare their nervous systems for the reality of those situations, but it does get their brains thinking about how they might like to handle them.
I love this. And there's also a really great toy company called Eboo, Eebo, and they make these really great card sets. Like, I heard your feelings. What do I do? And what's going on here? And there's scenarios like you're talking about that you play in this game, and it has some guidelines so you can really support your child in navigating social expectations, reading the emotions of different situations, social and logical inference, all of these things. It is a really, really amazing resource if you need like some guidelines to do that. And I also have an entire chapter in my book called Parenting Together, which is essentially how to bridge the gap between you and your parenting partner when you don't agree or you feel unsupported. And I have a lot of different tools, especially my conversation for bridging the gap, and a lot of tips in there as well.
I love the Eboo. That's I've never heard of them, so I'm gonna have to look them up. That sounds spectacular.
They're amazing.
Devin, thank you so much for your work to take the terror out of toddlerhood and to support parents to be the parents we want to be. You are making a difference. And more importantly, I believe that this parenting style is really gonna protect the next generation, make them less vulnerable to abuse, make them into the world changers we know that they can be.
Thank you so much. I believe the same. And that's why I'm out here every day doing this work. And I just want to thank everyone for being here and listening to this conversation.
Awesome. I will put all of Devin's information, including her new book, in the show notes. And I will be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.